Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm speaking to you from New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I'm coming to you, as I always joke, live from Macquarie, but we're actually recording this at night, so I'm at home and not at Macquarie University. I am here today with two amazing researchers, writers, scholars, who have written a fantastic book on women's football or women's soccer here in Australia. The authors of the book are Dr. Fiona Crawford, who's a writer, editor, researcher, whose work engages with social, environmental, and sports issues. And she writes for a range of publications, including 442, and works frequently with Football Australia. And also Dr. Lee McGowan, who's a researcher, writer, and teacher working at the University of the Sunshine Coast. And his primary research interests are at the intersection of sport, culture, and community engagement. And together, they are the authors of Never Say Die, the 100-year overnight success of Australian women's football, out with University of New South Wales Press in 2019. Hello, Fiona, and hello, Lee. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
Yeah, I love the book. We were joking before I turned on the recording. That's a very timely book. And since it's a very timely book, I guess we should ask, how did you come up with such a timely book? How'd you develop this project?
It's probably even worth going back to the beginning. So Lee and I met back in 2008 at an event called the Homeless World Cup, which is it's a football event, and they use football to tackle homelessness. And that's where we sort of first crossed paths. And then a couple of years later, I was about to go back and do my PhD, and Lee had actually finished his PhD and became my supervisor. So we went through this sort of PhD journey together, and he got me across the line, for which I'm forever grateful. And then once we got sort of past there, we looked up, could see a bit of, I think, space or a little bit of potential. And then we talked about, you know, this project, because we were constantly talking about football anyway, because we both loved it. And yeah, we kind of figured, let's give it a crack. Would you have anything to add to that, Lee? That's my recollection of it anyway.
Well, look, I think that's a very generous of you, Fiona. I think that your PhD was an amazing piece of work, and it was just a privilege to be working with you on it. I remember really distinctly us being at a W League game, and the girls, my girls who had been asking questions about when the game, when women had started playing and what was going on with it. And you were the first person I asked to help me answer their questions, because you had had me at, I remember, Fiona, we went to a game at ANZ Stadium in maybe 2016, 2017, mm-hmm. and there was only 500 people at it. Yeah. And then there we were last Saturday in Brisbane, and there's 25,000 people at a friendly. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was wild. It's wild. So I think, I mean, we were joking before we pressed record, but I think if we did anything right with this book, it was that we saw the potential and the uplift with women's sport, and we saw just how special it was and how many people would fall in love with it if it was given the right resources and attention. And I think, yeah, in writing the book, we both recognised the potential, but we also sort of, I think, rode on the coattails a little bit. Yeah, as people were falling in love with the Matildas, we gave them something to work with.
Yeah, I did. I have to say, like, when I was reading the book, you know, I'm a sports historian. I felt like I knew a fair amount about kind of, you know, the history of women's football, at least from a European point of view. But I have to admit, like, I learned a lot about what happened in Australia. And I also kind of felt like there was a through line of not just recovery or rediscovery, but also maybe a kind of, you know, corrective, like, hey, there's this great history that we can recover, but also there's lessons for the now and what was happening in the past. And maybe we should go back to some of these things. So I'm wondering, kind of, when you were writing it, did you write it as a kind of corrective, you know, a call for, you know, real women's organization of women's sports? Or was that just me reading it in a particular mood, I guess?
Keith, I think you've obviously been talking to the publicist for the book. It sounds like you've absolutely nailed the intent behind the book, but I'm going to hand it to Fiona to see what she thinks.
Oh, I would agree with that, absolutely. And I think those were the constant conversations we had before writing it and while we were writing it. It was as much about, here's some really fantastic things that have happened, but it was also about the same issues kept coming up and the same challenges, and that, you know, it felt like women's football was overcoming so many of them and then having to overcome them over and over and over. Was that what you would say, Lee? Or?
Oh, look, absolutely. I think one of the things I think is worth highlighting is that this was the books that a result of two complementary sets of knowledge, Keith. I had been unpacking that historical stuff, the 1920s stuff, and then the reemergence of the game, particularly in Brisbane in the 1960s, and then this kind of explosion that happened with the women's rights movements in the late 60s and early 70s as well. Whereas Fiona's really well connected and really knowledgeable about what's going on in the contemporary game, you know. So we came to the book bringing these two really complementary sets of knowledge, and so discussing those. Coming at it from those two ends of the conversation, if you like, was where we started to recognise these similarities. Although I would imagine, Fiona, these are challenges that you'd see across women's sport.
Absolutely. And I think part of the challenge is even working in the space, because there was no media coverage, because the games weren't broadcast, if people like me didn't see it, because I was often the eyes and ears for the team, it was sort of in my head, or if I didn't know who to go ask about something or to get tipped off by a family member or another player about, here's this thing you need to focus on, it never got discussed. And I think there's so much of that with women's football that, yeah, it was constantly us trying to find out and figure it out. And that has happened until, I think, the last couple of years. So for you to have to go through historical archives has been one way of finding that information. And for me, it was that contemporary level of, okay, I've met, you know, Caitlin Ford's mum, and she's told me a story about driving back and forth from Wollongong. So we're gonna investigate that a bit further. But it was relationships, or it was being tipped off. And I think there's just so much more that we still don't know that is in players' heads or administrators' heads that we just, yeah, so many stories that haven't been uncovered yet.
Yeah, that really struck me in reading the book. You know, I'm a academic in Australia too, so I've done the Trove searches, and so much of it you can find is amazing material. But then this book really couldn't have been written without these personal histories, these oral interviews, talking to the people in question. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that, Fiona, because it sounds like that was your expertise. But how did you, you know, how did you make these connections? And, you know, were people anxious to tell their stories, or did you have to coax it out of them, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Lee could probably explain this, but there were so many people who were surprised we were interested in their stories, because their stories had been so undervalued for so long. Particularly, their name escapes me, but I'm thinking the person who turned up to the FIFA camp and was sent home, Lee, that you wrote.
Yeah.
There's so many. Yeah. I mean, you could speak to that probably better than me, but it was just so many people who were first surprised that we were interested in some of the detail, because it seemed so mundane to them, or it was a long forgotten thing and nobody had ever shown any kind of interest before. But it was also then, once they understood, I think they trusted us. I think that's what it is. I'd worked with them for some time, so when I was asking them these questions, they thought, not really sure what you're going to do with this, but okay, yeah, sure, we'll answer your questions. And I think they were all pretty pleasantly surprised with what ended up being on the page. They're like, oh, you really were writing a book, or, oh, okay, we definitely got a bit of that. They're like, oh, it's like it's an actual book. But I think it's that so much of women's football doesn't get that attention, and there are so few books written about women's football. It was a bit of a learning experience, I think, for all of us. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a couple of, because we started the project, really for me, started in a research around the game in Brisbane. And so as well as looking at the historical stuff, I started talking to people who were playing the game in the early 70s, and met some people who played in the late 60s as well. And we put together an exhibition as part of that project that toured around Brisbane libraries, and I did a few presentations in libraries and stuff, and I was amazed at people turning up to see what had happened. But there was as many people in the audience who had come to say, well, I played, do you want to hear my story? As well as people who were turning up who were like, women's football, how long have women been playing football for? So it was amazing. And like, I'd invariably come home from these presentations with a bag full of stuff that someone had given me, newspaper clippings and photographs of medals and all sorts of stuff. But the Lynn Ketter story is particularly interesting in that Lynn had been involved in the really early 70s of women's football, and had wanted to become a coach, and went to the coaching training centre at Tullibudgerah, where all the men's football training was happening, and joined a course. Paid the money for a 5-day live-in course at Tullibudgerah. She did the C license first, and she was the only woman of the 48 people group on the training session, the training course, and I think that was a 3-day course. And then the B license is much more involved. It's a 5-day course, and so she turned up as the only woman in this group of 72 in the group and 71 men. And she took part on the first day and everything was fine. And then towards the end of the second day, this fella, his name is Eric Worthington, and we've since discovered that he was heavily involved in what was happening with English women's football. He was involved in stuff that was going on with that. But he turned up and told her effectively that FIFA had made an edict that women were not allowed to train on the same football pitches as men, and that Lynn had to get off the course, had to get off the training course. And so they wouldn't give her money back. They wouldn't even let her sit and watch what was going on. So they just sent her home after 2 days of this course, because apparently FIFA had told the football association organization, whoever was looking after the course, because it's a national course, there was people there from all over the country, and so they chased her away. But there's a few stories like that where, but for the strength and courage of a handful of individual women, the things wouldn't have changed. It would have stayed the way it was until probably the mid-90s, you know. But these women were really smart and really diligent in their approach, and were able to build an organisation for themselves in the 70s. Heather Reid, who was really generous in her interviews around the book, and and has been helping Fiona and I each on our current projects as well. And her dear friend Elaine Watson, who's the matriarch of Australian women's football. These are women who without them that the recognition and infrastructure for the game wouldn't be there, I think. I'll shut up now. Sorry, that was a lot.
No.
I would second that. It's just the women who have been involved in women's sport, but particularly women's football, are absolutely remarkable. And in some ways, I mean, no disrespect to men's football, but I think the stories are richer and the women who've been involved are just so extraordinary that, yeah, I come away sort of in awe of them, and they're my absolute heroes. So if we can do anything to contribute to making their stories known a little bit more widely, then, you know, it's job done for us, I think.
I think you all have done it, and it's definitely a real book, and by the way, much better than a lot of the books that you read about men's football. although you all are clearly, you know, that you respect and you are just so impressed with the work that these women have done. It doesn't read hagiographically. It's not, you know, the pay on to these great women. For people who haven't read the book, there are kind of two parts, I would say. I don't know if that was an intentional thing, but there's the historical part, and then there's the, you know, what are current issues that we're facing in the league? And the historical part, which we've been talking about a little bit, I think could be kind of underlined by the notion of organizational challenges that just again and again, women try to organize to play, and men's organizations say, no, you can't do that. and get in their way. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that history for people who don't know anything about women's football or women's soccer in Australia. Where does it begin? How does it get its start? And what are some of the challenges it faces? You've got, I guess, two really good chapters, Roaring 20s, and then not quite a half golden century that really delve into that.
This is probably where I was able to contribute most, Keith. The research on women's football in the UK has become incredibly rich now. There's lots of people working on it, but there hadn't been as much work done here. We knew there was a game played in Brisbane in 1921, and it was deemed as a spectacular event. Fiona and I both attended the centenary event to celebrate that last September. It was absolutely brilliant, and that was organised by Football Queensland. But what was less well known was the fact that that was actually a culmination of a number of football teams that had got off the ground in the local area. The women had formed their own association. They tried to affiliate with the men's association at the time, and the men wouldn't have it. The chairman wouldn't have it, buying into the propaganda that was being produced in the United Kingdom about women not being fit to play football, you know, and all sorts of spurious concerns about damage to reproductive systems and all sorts of stuff. But actually, it was really just about men looking to protect their corner from women who had this tremendous appeal in their football. It was something different. They were drawing huge crowds, earning massive gates in 1920 on December 26th. 53,000 people watched Dick Kerr ladies play against St Helens at Everton's ground, Goodison Park. That was followed up a few weeks later with a huge crowd at Manchester, 31,000 the report says at Manchester United's ground as well. And I think the problem was that the women were giving the money away to returning servicemen's charities, and obviously you can imagine these kind of stogie smoking factory owners who'd previously been creaming all the profits from the men's football, who were missing out on this profits, were kind of envious about how much money was being generated. So that was part of the issue, I think. Plus, as well, you had men returning from Europe, and coming back into the workplace, you know. And so it was deemed as being, the popularity of women's football was deemed as a threat to the men's game. And then the a couple of researchers, Alethea Melling, who was doing this research in the late 90s, and then Gene Williams, who you and I talked about briefly before we started the interview, just an absolute academic crush for me, started doing this brilliant work. And what they've kind of unpicked is that the straw, that the final straw really was when the women who were playing football started raising money to support the striking miners' families, the mothers and children of the striking miners. And so where the football was being used, as they saw, to support a kind of radical purpose, that was really it for the English Football Association, and they decided that they would ban women from playing football on English Football Association grounds. And when you ban people from playing on English Football Association grounds, effectively means you can play football, you just can't play anywhere that you're able to play football, you know. And so that had a huge impact on the game across Europe. Not only that, what we saw in Europe by the beginning of the 1970s, where things were starting to pick up again, and you had early European and World Cup tournaments starting to emerge in Europe, FIFA dampened things down again as well, by speaking to the associations and suggesting that they control women's football. And when I say control, that effectively just means suppress the women's game, you know. So the same thing happened again in the 70s, but by that time, the women just weren't having it by that time. You know, they were already started. It was already popular. The crowds for the games in the World Cup in the 70s were just enormous. You know, so there was clearly commercial opportunities there. So it wasn't just the women who wanted to play then. You actually had other people being interested as well. Now, that was happening in Europe. In Australia, it was a different story. Women really struggled because I think the Australian Soccer Federation, as they were known at the time, were really unsure of what to do about the women's game and the fact that there was this independent organisation. And really, I think, were a bit naughty and tried to disrupt the game a bit as well. So it was a different kind of challenge. Well, the women's game was being sponsored by Martini and Rossi and other people in Europe. The Australian game was scraping and struggling, and women were paying their own way and having Lamington drives and all sorts to start funding it. So, and the whole way, as Fiona has mentioned, as you've highlighted yourself, it was just men getting in the way, effectively. You know, not all men. There were allies. You know, the two guys from Preston and Glasgow who owned the company, the manufacturing company, Dick Kerr, Foundries, they were highly supportive of the women's team and actually sponsored the team until I think 1965 before they folded. So, but effectively, it was just men in positions of power just trying to make sure they held on to that power.
And sort of tangential to that, it was when we were writing the first draft of the book and even subsequent drafts, it was one of the real challenges in how to convey some of these issues without constantly sounding really negative, because what we really needed to frame it as, here's some remarkable women who've done some remarkable things to overcome some really difficult odds. But it was something we had to be really conscious of the whole time, because it would have been really easy to just write a book complaining about how hard it was to be a woman in football. I mean, you know, you could definitely have written that very easily. So yeah, it was a really conscious effort on our part to go, okay, we see that there were these men standing in the way, that we see that they were not getting funding or any kind of support, but how do we frame that as, here's what they did to overcome that and how awesome are they?
Yeah, I loved the just the diligence and the hard work, but also the creativity and the audacity of many of the women. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about then, you know, some of the people you mentioned earlier, Lane Watson, Heather Reed, Moya Dodd, and this organization that I think gets good press in your book, the Australian Women's Soccer Association. Where's that come from?
Well, it emerged really because at the time, so in the early to mid-60s in Sydney, a woman called Pat O'Connor, who was an immigrant from England, and her husband, they'd come over. They joined the St. George Budapest team in Sydney. And Pat was the driving force behind a league in Sydney City. Around the same time as that, you had a woman called Betty Hoare, who was instrumental in developing the game in Melbourne as well, and a whole bunch of. I'm just picking out a couple of names here to exemplify. There was obviously loads of women around them at the same time. There was a guy called Oscar, and I can't remember his second name now, but it's in the book, in Western Australia, who was instrumental in managing the kind of a women's association there. And then in Queensland, that was where Elaine Watson really emerged. She'd been involved in women's football, in men's football, in the early 60s. She was the first woman to referee a game of football in Australia. She refereed two men's teams in a game. She coached her sons as well, in teams as well. So she came in, she effectively was, I think, one of the first to say, right, this is enough. We need to fix this and start organising at a national level, state level, and then national level. So she was really the driving force behind the game developing in Queensland. And then I think she was instrumental in the organisation meeting up to play in Sydney in that 1974 tournament. And by that time, there was all sorts of people involved, you know, and like Heather Reid was there, and there was all sorts going on. And it was a national competition to play state teams, because the women saw, obviously, really early on that the only way to build on the strengths was collectively. And so having a national organisation led to having a national team. It led to playing games overseas, you know, and that had already started to happen during the 70s anyway. And those are the kind of key kind of, hubs for the game, and then coming together, the AWSA emerged out of that. And then before you knew it, I think by the late 70s, you had, there's already scandals. There was teams playing across in international teams, playing in the Invitational Tournament in Asia. The women's game in Asia had really started to build momentum there as well. And then they started playing tests against New Zealand as well. And from that, then, You've got some. They'd started to amass like a nucleus of really strong players. You mentioned Moya, Sue Monteith was another, Connie Byrne was another. Connie would later marry Jim Selby, who was the first coach of the team. And then they were obviously the kind of proto Matildas, you know, the first national women's team. And so now you've got really good players hungry to play and gain experience. Then they start looking at international tournaments and stuff as well. So it was the AWSA was integral to building momentum for the game, not just in Australia, but to connect with other associations like the New Zealand Women's Association as well. And then that led to the Oceania group as well in the early 80s. So and then really they were in charge of the governance of women's football right up until the Crawford Report forced everyone's hand and made all the football associations all merge together. So it was an incredible organisation, and like Heather Reid as the CEO of it was like just a driving force, you know. And Elaine was there for a bit and then away off doing other things. But there's like loads of brilliant people there who are still involved in women's football, like Kerry Harris, who's the chair of Women on Side, and so many others who've been involved in women's football and refereeing and all sorts of stuff that have all come out of that organisation. So it was just an amazing kind of engine for women's football.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I don't know if you want to jump in, Fiona, but since you mentioned the Crawford Report, Lee, I mean, that in some ways that comes up in your chapter, Making Their Own Way. And my reading on it was that it felt like you were writing about it as a, what's the best way to put it? At best, maybe a mixed blessing. What's your take on that? I mean, so that chapter, Making Their Own Way, you really brought the game into the 90s. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about what was going on in women's football. And yeah.
If you know no better, it was her dad that wrote that report, wasn't it?
Yeah, no relation. I think that period in particular is such a tricky one when you're looking at women's football, because, I mean, the men's football was taking all of the attention, but actually it was really it was taking the attention and the resources from the women's game. So that's mm-hmm. about the time that the AWSA was essentially forced to go under the auspices of Soccer Australia or whatever, you know, and then they later changed to Football Federation Australia. But they had their own issues and they were not really focused on women's football or interested in it or sending any resources that way. And so there was that real period around that time and around the Olympics where women's football just didn't ever get the injection of funding or attention that it could have. So I think when you look at women's football, particularly in the contemporary era, you can see so many, I guess, sliding doors moments where you think, oh, if that had just gone one different way, things would have been much further ahead much more quickly. And, I mean, I can point to so many. So, for example, 2011, we were at the Women's World Cup. So I'm conscious this is jumping quite a way ahead from the Crawford Report, but it's a good example of at the Women's World Cup. You'd come off the back of 2007 where SBS had shown every game. We thought, you know, something, there was a documentary. We thought there'd be some great stuff that would come from that, but it all kind of dissipated. And then you get to 2011 and they're not showing all the games at the World Cup. So that's a bit of a problem. They finally make it to the quarterfinals, at which point all the media get on board. So the game is going to be broadcast in Australia. And then the Matildas have an absolute, just a shocker of a game. It's just not up to their standard. But again, it was that cusp moment. If they had gone one step further in that quarterfinal, everyone really would have sat up, resources would have flowed into the game, but instead they went home and it all kind of dissipated, and then they didn't make the Olympics after that, so it fell away again. And there's so many moments like that. So for me, the Crawford Report is a bit of it's a juncture, or it's a kicking off of a decade or two where you just think, oh, if someone had just paid a bit more attention, thrown a few more resources their way, given them a few more opportunities, if a couple of games had gone their way, if there'd been some better sponsorship or some media coverage, we would have been a little bit further ahead than, like, we would have been more in the space where we are now. Because, for example, 2011, the US lost that final, but they had such an outstanding tournament and they won. Everybody fell in love with them. And so they went back to America and they were like heroes, even though they'd actually lost the final. And Australia could have been like that if we'd gone one game more. If that makes any sense. So yeah, Crawford Report, complicated feelings, I think.
There's a couple of brilliant sliding doors moments. Now you've mentioned that, Fiona, just before that as well. You know, like the bid for the World Cup next year was Australia's third bid for the World Cup. You know, like the bid in 1995 really didn't stand a chance. That was for the 1999 World Cup, but they were up against the US bid, which was being bankrolled to like the tune of $30 million or something, you know. And so Australia knew there was no chance of them being able to compete with that. And we're talking about the AWSA working with people at Football Australia at the time, the Australian Soccer Federation it was at the time. And then in 1999, they bid for the 2003 World Cup, and they'd learned some really valuable lessons coming off the back of their first experience of doing that. They printed up this fantastic glossy brochure, like really done the numbers on it. They had a fantastic campaign. They went across to the 1999 World Cup, and like all sorts of people were involved, Maria Berry and all sorts of people were party to that and putting it together. And their bid was so good and so strong that people were congratulating them on having won the bid before it had actually been announced. And then the Chinese Football Association and FIFA struck some kind of deal, and FIFA, like on the brink of awarding the tournament to Australia, then he gave the tournament to China, and who then couldn't host it anyway. It was the SARS breakout meant that it was hosted in the US in 2003 again, and that if they'd got that tournament then, that would have had such a massive impact for the AWSA. Just like 2003, you can imagine those two troubled decades that Fiona's just mentioned, it would have made such a difference to that. So if you think about it, $30 million the Americans were bankrolling their bid for in 1999. You know, the Australian government helped out with $5 million for the 2023 bid. That'll give you some idea of the kind of pressures around these processes. So that was definitely a moment there where I think that like things could have changed even before the Crawford Report came out, because the Crawford Report was really about addressing the problems in men's football. You know, women's football wasn't suffering from the same problems. And actually, there's a book called Shootout by Ross Sully, which is an absolutely brilliant kind of scathing analysis of the stuff that was going on around that period as well, if you wanted to look at that into that further. It's a really brilliant book. So, yeah, I think if you want to, you could probably mention more sliding doors moments as well, eh?
Yeah, maybe even the calendar. I mean, I'm hesitant to mention that because I feel like the calendar gets a bit too much airtime.
It's the only thing people might know, you know, if they're not.
Yeah, it really is. And it's so tricky because I think there's much richer things that happened in women's football, but I also understand why it does get, you know, but it's that same moment of there's no funding in women's football. And although many of the players do feel quite empowered to have participated in the nude calendar, there's all these complicated feelings that you have around it, because if they'd actually been being paid properly, if they had the proper opportunities, they probably wouldn't have had to even consider participating in a nude calendar. So, yeah, it's another one of those sliding door moments. And it also, there were 12 players involved, but it did affect the entire team's reputation for decades. I think we've only recently kind of shaken it off a little bit, and I think it is still likely to pop up at various times. But, yeah.
I think as well, it's always worth keeping in mind the context around that as well. At the time, nude calendars in Western and global Northern cultures, particularly in England and in the US, you know, there was nude policemen and nude firemen and all sorts of nude calendars. It was all the rage at the time. So it wasn't really as much of a publicity grabbing stunt as it's made out to be out of context. You know, actually, they've made a film about it. There's a really brilliant story about a country women's association in Northern England doing one. You know, these women hiding behind their knitting and stuff. That was a massive story a couple of years, just maybe 18 months before. So they were really a big deal at the time. And as well, I'd say that, as Fiona said, at the time it was about raising some pay for the players, compensation for their efforts, because they weren't being paid. They were pretty much volunteering. And even then, at the end of the day, they didn't even make that much money from it. You know, the amount of money that they each managed to gain from it was a pittance compared to although there was the added benefit of some of them being able to leverage the experience and get some money doing a Japanese toothpaste advert after it, you know, and making a bit of extending the funding from it afterwards, you know. But I think it's hopefully we've moved past it now. People are looking at the football now. I mean, the crowds at the Euros was amazing. People are watching the football. People see the crowds are really different in that. And so hopefully we can move beyond it.
And they're finally getting the broadcast and the media coverage that they should have had all along. So, and that makes all the difference, because when you can see the games, you can actually support the team and you can do that consistently. And that's what's really been absent, I think, even to the last 5 years or so. So, yeah.
Even just buying supporters' jerseys and stuff like that, right? Buying replica jerseys that are made for women and stuff like that.
Oh, huge. I used to get, because I was doing their social media, I used to get all these direct messages and, yeah, from fans sort of imploring me to tell them where they could possibly buy a Matilda's jersey for themselves or for their children. And it was such a difficult thing, because I would constantly take those messages back to Football Federation Australia and say, hey, look, there's a market here. There's people are really after these, but it was really difficult to justify. And obviously I understand, because there was a great expense with jerseys, but it's really heartening to see now that that's the balance has finally tipped on that and you can get those jerseys and, hey, you know what, there is actually a market for it.
I'd say there's maybe a bigger market, although I have to admit a few, I don't, when did the U.S. come into Sydney and play at Combank against Matildas? We went with my daughter and both of her parents are American, but she was born in Australia and has Australian citizenship. And we asked her, do you want Team USA? You know, smiling, or do you want Matilda's? And she said, no, Daddy, I'm Australian. I want Matilda's. So we went everywhere. We went to every shop in Bondi Junction trying to find a Matilda's jersey and couldn't find one. But
yeah, it's a bit hit and miss still, for sure.
Yeah. But you have another fan. She only likes Matilda's, Swans, and the Sydney Sixers because they wear pink. But
priorities.
Good reason as any.
Really, as far as I'm concerned, it's as good a reason as any. Hearing you both talking about sliding door moments, so it made me think too, and we don't have to talk about this, I just thought I'd mention it, also the men's bid and how much money the government spent on that in an utterly futile effort to get the men's game. And if they contributed that money instead to the women's side, they almost certainly would have.
You know, fun fact is I was actually I was a crowd extra in that ad for that failed bid. And I also even went and bought an inflatable kangaroo to be part of that ad and claimed it on my tax that year because I did get paid. Which was, I think my accountant every year when I turn up and I go, he's like, are you seriously trying to claim an inflatable kangaroo? And I was like, yes, I am. But yeah, it is a bit of a sore point because I was so excited to be in that ad and it was such a crushing moment. And yeah, it is, like you say, there's so much money that's thrown at the men's game with very little thought. I mean, and they are not required to justify every cent in the same way that women's sport is, whereas you are given so little in women's sport and yet you are, you know, eking out every cent and you're having to justify that there's, you know, there's a market or that you really do deserve this money. And I find that quite, things that are given to the men by default without any second thought, you have to justify and justify and justify in women's sport.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to, if you wanted to say something, Lee, I don't mean to interrupt, but your last chapters of your book deal with some of the kind of contemporary issues that facing women's football, women's soccer here in Australia. So you have your kicking domestic goals, show them the money, overcoming injuries, coaches, the future is female. Women's World Cup international tournaments, and where do you go from here? But one of your chapters is about money, and I'm on the record. I've written a few pieces about basically saying pay the women.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. The week we released the book, and I had written obviously that pay parity or a lot of those later chapters because it's the more contemporary stuff. The week we released the book, the Matildas announced their groundbreaking pay parity deal. So I had this moment, and Lee had it as well, of this absolute euphoria of releasing this book and absolute euphoria of, you know, hearing the Matildas have achieved pay parity, and then that sheer terror where you think, oh, my God, is our book immediately out of date?
It's impact.
It was amazing, though, because I went back and reread it, and it remarkably did actually hold up. Like, obviously it didn't say that they'd achieved pay parity, but you know, I don't know, thanking my past self, how I'd written the chapter was actually still kind of held up and it still made a lot of sense. So I was very relieved and very pleased. And obviously then media really wanted to talk to us about the book because suddenly you know, everyone's talking about the Matilda's Pay parody. So it was a, it was impeccable timing, we have to say.
Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the issue for people who aren't, because not all of our listeners are Australian, so they won't be familiar with what the pay disparity was like in Australian football, and maybe why it was so so shocking that the Matildas were paid so much less than the men.
Well, I think there's a really brilliant example of the differences when you look at since 2016, the US women's national team have been earning more revenue for US soccer than the men's team. And in 2016, when that happened, the men's team, men's players were still being paid more than five times the salary of what the women's players were being paid. And at that point, they'd already won like two World Cups, maybe three World Cups, you know. And so you're looking at paying your World Cup winners a fifth of what the men's team were being paid. So like, even if you don't go close to home, then there's the perfect example. And it's and the fact that it wasn't just about parity, it's become a political statement for football associations to pay the women the same as the men, you know, like speaks to how dramatic a move it is for outside of the kind of orthodoxy of the way that football's governed, you know. Mm-hmm. I think there's that even before you look at the scale of the difference.
And I could probably just add to that is I was working directly with the Matildas doing their social media at the time, and I saw firsthand just how hard the players were working and how many things they were juggling. They were all working casual jobs. They were all studying. They were all then so generous. Every time I asked them to do something, there was never any complaint. I mean, they must have been exhausted fitting in everything that they were doing, plus doing all their training as an elite athlete. And one, I put the example in the book, but Katrina Gorry was named the best player in Asia, and she literally flew back. So they flew her back a business class seat, but she went straight from there to working in a cafe, because you can be the best player in Asia, but when you're a woman, you're not paid enough, so you have to still go work a casual job in a cafe. And she was actually having to field media inquiries by the, you know, the rubbish bins out the back of the cafe on her break, because that's how much she was having to juggle just to, yeah. And for me, that was a really stark reminder of you can be the best player and you still can't pay your bills.
Well, thankfully, things are changing, though. You know, like the amount of football that's been generated in Europe at the moment there. We've just had the biggest transfer fee for a women player. The lassie for Man City's moved to I think, Barcelona for £350,000, you know. So that's a sign of it will be a race now for clubs to get to the first £1 million signing. And that'll be, like, that happened in 1981 in English football. So that'll give you an idea of how long it's taken for things to change, you know, how long it's taken for women to receive similar recognition to the men. And all the rubbish about people not wanting to watch it and there not being an audience in that, I think, like, you only just have to look at the Euros tournament there in June and July to see that that's a nonsense, you know. They couldn't, the tickets were difficult to get, you know. They were selling out all the stadiums. Massive crowds, 18 million people watching it from home in England, same in Germany, watching the final, you know. Like people are happy to watch it. They love the quality of the football. So it's really just like people who don't know any better keep taking cheap shots at the women's game out of ignorance more than anything else, rather than giving it a chance, you know. And, like, I still meet football supporters now who are like, been football supporters all their lives, who are like, oh, I'm not watching the women's football, you know. And I'd be like, sort yourself out, you know, like, just watch it. Just have a look and see. The football is amazing, you know. So I think things will change, you know, like really dramatically, but we're already on the way. And I think even better than that, when you look at clubs like Lewis FC, just outside Brighton in England there, where the women, it's a club level, the women are being paid the same as the men. It's a community club. Whole families are going, they're serving fresh, healthy food at the food stand instead of pies and bovros and the chips, you know, and it's become a whole of community thing rather than it just being about guys going to watch a game of football on a Saturday afternoon. You know, that's the kind of thing that you go to the women's football for. It's great crack, it's safe, it's friendly, it's a buzz, you know, and so, like, the more people see that, the more people will want to go.
And if I could just add to that, I mean, I will never say that missing out on the 2003 Women's World Cup bid was a good thing, but gee, I think we've got to, you know, hosting it in 2023 is probably, the timing could not be better. I think women's football is on such, the ascendancy is just enormous, and I think we could not have timed it better. So I guess speaking of, you know, good timing, I don't think we could have timed it better to be hosting a World Cup. I mean, everybody is really starting to get on board with women's football. And if you're looking at the Euros, you think, God, it can only, like, how much bigger can it get? It's just going to be massive.
No, so one of your chapters, and by the way, for people who are listening, all these chapters on the contemporary issues, they're really rich. I really liked one of my favorite, for example, was about the coaching. Since you all seem keen to chat about Women's World Cup and the trajectory and the timing of it, I wonder if you could talk about the trajectory of the Matildas. I mean, where do we, obviously the first women's team, national team in Australia wasn't the Matildas. Where do we get the Matildas from? What's their trajectory been in the last, 20 years? And maybe your own thoughts on if we'll get to see them hoisting any trophies soon. You may hope that, but as you might guess, I have a different view.
Yeah. I mean, Lee, do you want to start? Or?
Well, look, the Matildas, the name didn't arrive until 1995, I think. Yeah. It was a competition. Yeah. And it could have been, like, thankfully it landed on the Matildas. It couldn't have been all sorts of mad stuff. But the first Australian women's national team, the first one, emerged out of those national competitions I talked about in the late 70s, where each of the state football associations were congregating in a different state each time to play a national level tournament, and then the squad for the national team was selected from that, and then they started playing tests. New Zealand came here and they went across New Zealand and played a few test matches, and then started getting involved in 1983. They went and played the Oceania Cup in Noumea, New Caledonia, and they played against Fiji and New Caledonia. I can't remember if PNG were there or not, but New Zealand won that tournament in 1983. And so that's for this region, that's the first time international football, those are the first times that international football had started to, was being played, you know. And you've got players like we said, Moya, but also other players, the lassies from Brisbane, Joe and her Milman? Sister Kerry.
Milman?
Yeah. Joe Milman and her sister Kerry. And I think Joe played like 600 club games for our club in Easts in Brisbane. Yeah, like it's just, like, incredible, right?
And was never benched, I don't think.
And then still heavily involved in the game now. And I think she played an amazing amount of caps. And considering, like, they might have only been seen to have played like maybe 10 or 12 full internationals between 1979 and 1987, you know. So for them to have gained as many caps as they had over the course of a decade, that's an international career for a footballer, you know. These are just remarkable women, really. And that was before they became the Matildas, really. But since the 90s, where people have started paying attention, and Fiona's already mentioned 2007, which was a real kind of watershed moment, I think. And then each of the World Cups has got successively bigger in terms of people's awareness, attention. The 2019 tournament was incredible. You know, every game was televised on SBS, picking up massive audiences. And, you know, like, I think there was like an estimated 5,000 Australian fans travelled to France and travelled with the team. And like that, like that's an amazing measure of popularity in the game. So, and now you've got the likes of Ellie Carpenter picked regularly. I say regularly, picking up European Champions League medals, and Sam Kerr on $1 million, $2 million contracts, and all that. You know, it's just been a phenomenal rise to popularity. But it's all based on like hard work, quality, and luckily there's enough people still around who played in those early days who are able to kind of keep people grounded and remind them of. And Sam herself, you know, like things were pretty rough when she started her international career as well. So there's this kind of brilliant sense of it being grounded, and there's like, you know, I don't think anybody's allowed to be a diva too much anyway, you know, and in the way that we see in men's football, you know, so there is that.
And I would probably just add to that is the product has always been good. It's just that there hasn't been the supporting resources around it, whether that's the investment so the players can actually focus on their football, or it's the sponsorship, or it's the media coverage. And that's probably the difference we've seen in the recent decades. And what's really exciting is we're starting to see all those extra pieces that are always sitting around men's football, but we're now starting to see them sit around women's football. And I don't feel like they're going away. Whereas in the past, just because you got it once, it didn't mean that it was going to stay there. And I would probably just add, I, you know, the Matildas are not going to win the World Cup. And if we can reset our expectations a little bit, they're a really good team. Like they really are. And they're a top 10 team, but they're not a top two team yet. Like we've got a long way to go in our football development in Australia. So I really, really just want to reset expectations that the win is actually us hosting the World Cup. What Australia and New Zealand will gain from hosting it is already enormous. And so, you know, we've already won with that. However the Matildas go from here is going to be, you know, that's a bonus, really.
I personally would probably tip a European side to win this time around. But you never know. I mean, the ball's round. The game lasts 90 minutes. What else do we know?
Look, I wouldn't ever discount the US either. They've got that real that mentality of like we are gonna take it right up to our opposition. So yeah, European or the US.
The US has a lot of experience. I think there needs to be a bit of a change of the guard, and I wonder what the team will look like that they bring. But there's a lot of great players here in Australia, over in Europe, and in the US that are a lot of fun to watch. I want to mention one thing too about your all's book. We haven't talked that much about it, but for listeners, this is not just a book about the Matildas or like the top, 25 or 30 women's players at any time. This engages a lot with the bottom and the top. So it's many of the chapters deal with some of the more organizational issues as well. So I know we're talking about kind of the highlight stuff, but that's everything that's in the book. So I guess I just want to finish by asking you kind of, I guess two more questions quickly. The first would be, and I hopefully both of you answer this, and from our earlier conversation, it sounds like you'll have interesting things to say. But the first question would be, what's the future then for Australian women's football? Is it all up, or are there clouds on the horizon? Hopefully not. And the second question would be, after we're done talking about this, what other things can we look forward to reading from you next? So I know you both were joking about next books, next projects before, and I'd love to hear about them.
Sure, I'll let you start, Lee, if you'd like.
Thanks. Luke, I think I was heartened to hear Fiona ring that message about tempering our expectations about World Cups. And I think you're right that the way the game is in Europe at the moment, like the quality of the football, Germany played in that final without their best player, you know, like it's, like both those teams that got to the finals of the Euros are going to be really hard for the Americans or the Canadians to beat. So it's like if you wanted a kind of bellwether on where the football's at, the quality of the football that we'll see the World Cup next year will be the best women's football we've ever seen, I think. So that's something that's really worth looking forward to. I think that whilst the Matildas squad may not be at the same level as those teams I've just mentioned, what we're seeing in players like Karakunni Cross and Courtney Vine and Nalassie Niven, and you know, like there's some fantastic young players, Mary Fowler coming through, you know. So the people like Ray Dower and the young Matildas coach as well, Leah Blaney. Is it Leah Blaney?
Yes.
Fiona, have I got that right?
Yep, Tanya Oxby as well. Yep.
Yeah, you know, like these are coaches who've ensured that we're not just looking at like a golden generation of players, you know, like there's a real kind of pipeline of quality coming through. So that's fantastic. I think that's really heartening in terms of how the game goes. And then did you want me to hand to you now, Fiona, before I start banging on about the books that I'm working on?
Oh, no, go for it. You're all right.
So I'm working on three books at the moment, Keith. One we're just about to finish putting together is an anthology of called Intersections of Creative Writing, Sport and Society, where we've put together an anthology about creative writing and sport and all different facets of how creative writing and sport are used and are come together. I'm about halfway through finishing writing up a book called Women's Soccer in Oceania. That's why I was across in Fiji for the OFC Women's Nations Cup. A really brilliant tournament to be at, because with New Zealand, who would usually be the team that wins that tournament, hosting the Women's World Cup, they've automatically qualified. So for the first time in that tournament's history, it was looking like it was definitely going to be a different team from Australia or New Zealand who've dominated that tournament in the past. So that was really exciting to be there for that. And Fiji got to the final, so as you can imagine, it was really brilliant. So we're working on that. And then no sooner will that one be finished in November, we'll finish up writing one called Beach Soccer History. So we've been looking at and investigating the development and history of the game of beach soccer. And I think all three of those all come out next year with Rutledge and Springer, as the anthologies with Springer. So that'll be really exciting to have them done. And I'm, to be honest with you, I'm in my happy place. That's where I love working on that stuff. So it's been really busy, as you can imagine, but also really exciting too.
So if I go back to the first question, when you were saying what does the future look like, and is it going to be sort of all upwards from here? I think we're going to hit some, there are going to be some clouds, and that's actually probably not a bad thing, because we've had a few years where it's been very exciting for women's football, but I think we need to really shore up some of those foundations. And maybe that is, one of those is resetting the expectations around the Matildas are a really good team, but they need more resourcing and more development pathways for players coming through. We've had the golden generation, and we need something a little bit more solid than just talent. We need some more resourcing, so you really are seeing players come through from those early years, because that's what's happening in Europe now. I think maybe going back to when you mentioned coaching before, Keith, and that's a space where there really is some room for improvement. As you know, we haven't got a woman coaching the national women's team, whereas Germany, for example, has a policy of developing women coaches, and even the players they go and do, I think, if I understand this correctly, they also do their licenses, so they're bringing through players and giving them a career path past their playing years. So I think lots of opportunities in that space for Australia to do a little bit better, and so that maybe the next World Cup we can actually have a woman coaching, and maybe an Australian woman. I mean, there's women like Ray Dower who are fantastic, or Leah Blaney, Tanya Oxtoby, as Lee mentioned, and maybe it's time for them, or Mel Andriata, maybe it's time for them to have the mentorship and the support so that they can actually really succeed in that top job as well. In terms of next things, is I've got a book coming out as well. It's about Women's World Cups, so it will be out early next year, ahead of the World Cup. So a bit like Lee, I am feverishly trying to get that finished. Then just really looking forward to the World Cup. I know it's going to be big. I've been to a couple of the other World Cups, and I've seen them grow year on year, and all the viewer numbers, all the crowd figures, the quality of the football, you know, surpasses the previous World Cup every time you see one. But I still can't quite imagine how good 2023 is going to be. I just think what we're going to see in terms of the quality of the football, but also suddenly that awakening of worldwide interest in women's football is, yeah, if the Euros were anything to go by, I think it's just going to be extraordinary.
I know I'll be in the audience, and probably my family as well. I'm very much looking forward to the Women's World Cup here in Australia. Oh, man, this has been such a great conversation, Lee and Fiona. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun.
Thanks very much, Keith. Aye, it's great. Thanks for reading the book and giving us the opportunity to talk about it.
No, the second best part of this gig, other than getting to talk to other fascinating researchers, is getting to read the books and having a good excuse to go, oh, no, I just need to read this book. Thank you both. Yeah. So you all have been listening to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. I've been speaking with Dr. Fiona Crawford, who's a writer, editor, and researcher whose work engages with social, environmental, and sports issues, and who writes for a range of publications, including 442, and who works frequently with Football Australia, and Dr. Lee McGowan, who's a researcher, writer, and teacher at the University of Sunshine Coast, whose primary research interests are the intersection of sports, culture, and community engagement. And we've been talking about their fantastic, yes, it's a real book. Never Say, it's a very real book. You can pick it up very easily. Never Say Die, the 100-year overnight success of Australian women's football, out from the University of New South Wales Press in 2019 in a very handsome paperback that I have here next to me. And of course, I'm Keith Rathbone, coming to you live, as I say, from Macquarie University. Thank you very much for joining us.